This is Carolina Catholic Media Showcase.
So I have a question for you. How many slaves work for you? Yes, you heard me. How many slaves work for you? You say, what? Slavery? Here? We don't have slaves in our country. What are you talking about? Slavery ended a long time ago here. I think it was, if I remember my history right, it was around the Civil War, right? 1864, 1865, Emancipation Proclamation. We don't have slaves anymore. So why are you asking me this? Well, the truth of the matter is that there are slaves all over the world, including in our country. In fact, there are more slaves today than there were at the height of the slave trade in the 1850s. People are being bought and sold. They are being held against their will. They are being made to do things that they do not choose to do, and they cannot leave their situations. That's slavery. Now, recently we've been calling it by a different name, human trafficking. And so I hear some of you saying, oh, I know human trafficking. That's prostitution, right? Well, a piece of human trafficking is definitely the commercial slave trade. Another very large piece of it is forced labor. And I will be concentrating my remarks today on the forced labor piece of this huge human rights issue. A few months ago, in June of 2014, the International Labor Organization published a report that estimated that forced labor is a $150 billion a year global enterprise. And that's an estimate because this is a hard crime to count. Granted, $99 billion of that is estimated to be in the commercial sex industry. The other $41 billion is forced labor of some sort. Well, I hear the skeptics and I hear the arguments. Well, it's not happening here. Why don't I see it? Or it may be happening somewhere else. What does that have to do with me? Or, you know, in some of those countries, they're really, really poor. So whatever the income is that they can get, isn't that a good thing? And since I don't see it, and since it's not that big of a deal here, at least if I could see it, maybe I could tell, it's really not my problem. And yet I say it is all of our problem. Labor trafficking, forced labor, touches all of us. Think about it. Where does the food come from that we enjoy every day? What about that great lunch? Who grew the food? Who harvested it? Who processed it? Who got it to our table? What about your clothing? Who made it? Is it being made in a sweatshop in some other country or right here in the United States? What about the services that you enjoy every day? Maybe out at restaurants or at a nail salon, or you stayed in a hotel, and all those services. Are those workers being paid for their work? Can they come and go as they choose? And all the electronics that we rely on every day, cell phones and laptops, videos. Where are the components coming from? Who is mining those? Is it forced labor in some part of our world? Is it child labor? What about that young woman who works down the street as a nanny? Can she come and go as she please? Is she being forced to do what she does? And so I hear the wonder, well, all those people that you talked about, I don't see them being tied up in any way. Why don't they just leave? Well, I will tell you that an awful lot of the people who are in forced labor cannot leave, for the psychological chains are so strong that are holding them bound. They have been threatened. If you don't do what I say, something very bad will happen to you or to someone that you love. I know where your grandma lives. She's dead if you don't do what I say. You'll never see your baby again. So those chains are extremely strong, stronger than any physical ties could be. That kind of coercion keeps people bound. Many people who are lured into the forced labor of any kind are lured there because of some great promise, a wonderful job with opportunities for advancement, a great education, the opportunity to make a lot of money. All those are promises. Many times they're promises that are way too good to be true. And then some who fall victim to this crime are actually held by some kind of force, some constraint, some way of keeping them bound by being locked up in some manner, or perhaps addicted to drugs as a way of keeping them under control. Regardless of the methods used, these are all people who are victims of a crime. They would never recognize the words human trafficking, but they are victims of a crime, and they are too afraid to self-report or self-identify. They have been threatened. Well, I hear you saying, well, how's this going on? Aren't there laws against this crime? Well, yes, there are. Virtually every country in the world has condemned human trafficking. And many, many of those have laws in place. In fact, the United States government, through the Department of State Office to Monitor Trafficking in Persons, does a study every year and writes a very large report in which it rates every country's performance in terms of their efforts toward preventing the crime, protecting the victims, and prosecuting the perpetrators. Also, every one of our 50 states now has laws in place to counteract human trafficking. But legislation is never enough to counteract a crime so complex. It's not going to solve our problems. What about the victims and their needs, which are very complex? They certainly need the basics. They need a safe place to be. They need food. They need clothing. They're likely to need medical care because they have been mistreated. And they're certainly likely to need psychological care, mental health services that are not just short term, because they've suffered the kinds of complex trauma that Jamie was talking about this morning. They have huge needs. They may have legal needs. They may have done things in their through force that were against the law. They may be in this country without documents. Those legal needs become key. What about their education needs, their employment needs for the future? And what about preventing the crime to begin with? How do we reduce the demand? This certainly requires the participation of all of us. One of the first steps in starting to combat the crime of human trafficking is, first of all, to realize our own complicity, especially in labor trafficking. How are we already complicit in this crime? One of the ways is a challenge that I would pose to you. It's a quick little survey, and it is called the Slavery Footprint. You can find this on the web. Maybe some of you have already done it. The survey starts out, you think, well, this is kind of cute. What it's going to ask you are questions about your lifestyle. What kind of a home do you live in and where is it located? What's your car like? What are the meals like in your home? What are the foods that you enjoy every day? What about your clothing? What's in the closet? How many of different kinds of items and where were they made? What about the electronics that you're relying on in your home or your office? The places you enjoy going, out to restaurants or hotels or travel of any kind. Where are those places and how many times do you do those things? And at the completion of the survey, you're told how many slaves work for you. I was shocked and embarrassed to find out that 18 slaves work for me. And I thought I lived a pretty simple life. So now I face the challenge of how to reduce that number. The Slavery Footprint website also gives you that opportunity to learn how you might reduce the number of slaves. So taking that first step is one of the ways to begin working on this problem together. And then becoming motivated to learn more. What is this crime? How do I recognize it? What are the red flags? What should I be noticing when I'm out? What's happening around me? When I go to a restaurant, especially an ethnic restaurant, are the waiters and service staff able to interact and look at me? Did I just see sleeping bags in that kitchen? That's weird. What's that about? Or that nail salon, one of the favorite places for lots of people. Can the technician interact at all with me? Or is he or she so focused on only the work that they never make eye contact, they only talk to the one at the register? That's weird too. So what's going on right around me? What about the products that I really, really like? What do I do about that? How do I check it out if there's slavery involved? There is a website called knowthechain.org. Take your favorite product and go to knowthechain.org and look it up and see if there's any slavery in that supply chain. That's one of the challenges, because then, once you know, you can solicit that company, you can write to them, you can tell them that you don't want slavery in their products and that you will take your loyalties elsewhere if you discover it. If there's something happening and you think it's really unsafe or you just want to know more about it, there is a National Human Trafficking Resource Center hotline that is answered 24/7. The number is sort of weird, but it's memorable. It's 888-37-37-888. It's answered in Washington, D.C. You'll be asked where you're calling from, but you don't need to give your name. You can call with a tip. You can call for information. A victim can call for services. They want to know where you're calling from so that they can put you in touch with the local resources. So I encourage you to just call to find out what the local resources would be in this area. You can also call the FBI. You can call the local police, who are much more informed about the issue than they were even a year ago. So people are learning, they want to reach out, and they want to help. So I challenge you to find out how many slaves work for you, and then to do what you can to reduce the suffering of those who are enslaved. Thank you.
AM 1270 Catholic Radio Charlotte on the Carolina Catholic Radio Network. On air, online, and on the new Carolina Catholic Radio mobile app. Get involved and connect. Learn, love, and live your faith. CarolinaCatholicRadio.org.
This is In Good Faith, a conversation about the experience of living faith in everyday life. I'm Sister Maxine, and my guest is Sister Anne Victory, who has led efforts against human trafficking for over a decade. In 2007, she helped to establish the Collaborative to End Human Trafficking. One result of the Collaborative's work is that over 60 agencies in Northeast Ohio, law enforcement, healthcare, social services, and others, are now connected to weave a safety net for the men, women, and children who are victims of human trafficking. Sister Anne is Director of Education at the Collaborative, and her background includes extensive experience as a nurse clinician, educator, and administrator. She joins me today from her office in Cleveland. Welcome, Sister Anne. Thank you for being here today.
I'm delighted to be with you today, Maxine. Thank you for inviting me.
You've done a lot of work to raise public awareness through education about human trafficking. And let's talk about your ministry at the Collaborative in a moment. But first, could you describe, Anne, how your own awareness about human trafficking was awakened? Was there a particular event or situation, or was it more of a gradual understanding?
Well, it actually came about because of two interacting things at play at the time. In late 2006, some of us attended a seminar that was really focused on immigration, and the term human trafficking came up. We didn't know what it was. We had never heard of it. We were shocked when we found out what it was and decided we needed to do something together. Now, this was a group of representatives from various religious communities in the Cleveland area. And so we decided we had to figure it out together. Nobody could take this on alone. And at the same time, there was an effort by the Sisters of Charity Foundation to support collaborative work among religious communities. So it seemed like those two things converged and gave us the impetus to move forward on it. As a result, the Collaborative got formed. We met until we figured out how we could do it, what we could do, and eventually we had two co-founders. One was Sister Toby Lardy and the other was Karen Walsh, who actually were the two co-founders and began this journey of us together. And since that journey, we've expanded our collaboration much, much farther than religious communities, but they remain at the heart and the foundation of what we began back in 2007.
You mentioned that you and the other sisters, as you began to learn about human trafficking, you mentioned being shocked by some of the things that you were learning. Why was that?
We were just amazed that this was going on in our time because, you know, we thought slavery had been abolished after the Civil War and didn't really think about people were still being bought and sold. They're still being held against their will, forced to do things that they aren't choosing to do. So it really widened our perspective about that issue being global, of course, but a deepening awareness that it was still going on right in our country.
Say more about that, the situation of forced labor and what that means.
It actually means that people are being held against their will to do work they are not choosing to do. And they don't necessarily get any pay or very little pay for what they do. And other people benefit from that slavery work. So we see it going on and don't even recognize it. So that's part of the issue. It's not recognized for what it is. And sometimes we'll think, well, yeah, that happens in other countries. But it certainly doesn't happen now. And I don't participate in that. Well, we need to think again, because think of the purchases that we make and how are they those products being made? Are people enslaved so that I can get a cheap t-shirt? I have to think about those things. It's a huge challenge for most of us to let it into our brains, let alone influence our activity, our daily practices.
So forced labor isn't limited to just certain industries or certain types of work. And it's not just in regard to sex trafficking, which I think sometimes is what people assume that it is. So what you're describing, though, is very widespread and very diverse.
It certainly is. It certainly is. And a lot of groups do address sex trafficking and should, and we do too. And we include labor trafficking because we need to broaden that perspective. People need to understand it as a much deeper, broader issue.
Let's go back just a little bit to where you were when the Collaborative to End Human Trafficking was founded back in 2007. What were you doing at that time?
Actually, at that time, I was serving on the leadership team for the Sisters of the Humility of Mary and was located in Cleveland, so had a relationship with those who were the ones founding the organization. And our leadership team wanted us to have representation on these new efforts. So I was a volunteer, perhaps you would call it, as a member of the steering committee for the group as it originally was founded.
So then when your term of leadership was over, you joined the Collaborative as the Director of Education.
Yes, I didn't know what I would do after leadership. And it became pretty apparent that here's an opportunity because Sister Toby, who was serving at the time with the Collaborative, was elected to leadership. So we tease each other about trading places at that point, although she's pastoral leader now and is about to end her term. So who knows what's next?
And before your time in leadership, you were in healthcare for many years. How did your healthcare experience and your healthcare background affect the way that you looked at your ministry in the Collaborative?
As I look back, it's the work of God all along, getting me ready to do this kind of work. I had been an educator of nurses and of staff, one of my previous positions. I'd also been the vice president for mission. So I had a sense of needing to be involved in mission in a significant way. And the mission of this group really touched me and I had passion about it. I also knew that people in healthcare were probably seeing those who had been trafficked and not recognizing the fact that that was the case, and that therefore not responding appropriately. So as we learned much more about the issue, it just became much more apparent that this is where I belonged. And I could begin to work with the healthcare organizations in the greater Cleveland area as part of that work going forward. So in fact, my patients, who used to be my individual patients, now the whole community is my patient, so to speak.
With a great deal of experience as an educator about human trafficking, do you ever now look back to when you were in nursing and wonder about patients you encountered? Maybe some who now you realize might have been in a situation that involved trafficking?
Definitely. I think of so many patients that I cared for, and if I had only known what was really going on, I probably would have intervened in a different way or supported them in a much more holistic way.
As a member of a religious community, of course, we don't just discern our ministry alone. How is your congregation, the Sisters of the Humility of Mary, part of that discernment? And was there something in your congregation's tradition and its values that influenced that decision?
When the whole issue of needing to do something about human trafficking came up among the various religious communities in the greater Cleveland area, the Sisters of the Humility of Mary stood up big time and supported the founding of the organization with grants and salaries for Sister Toby and Karen and a space for the work. All of those things was like hook, line, and sinker. We're in this. We're doing this. We've always been ones who will respond to the needs of the time, and this is an emerging need of our time right here. We need to address it. So it was pretty energetic and wholehearted in terms of a response.
And it seems like that group of sisters and the congregations were reaching that understanding together, seeing the need and taking action.
Yes, it was a huge, broad feeling, and those religious congregations, six of whom are now focused in the Cleveland area, are totally in. They do respond with their presence, their financial support, their backing, their prayer support, all of those things. And the seventh one is in Akron, not too far away. They're also ones who are fully engaged in the Akron area on the issue.
Let's talk about your role as the Director of Education at the Collaborative. I understand that you give presentations about human trafficking to many different kinds of groups. What particular kinds of groups do you talk with?
We will talk to any group that wants a presentation. Now, when we started out, we focused primarily on those with whom we had easy relationships, like church groups, schools, and the word of mouth kept spreading, so we get invitations from quite a few others. We have expanded to address businesses, healthcare providers, social service agencies, law enforcement, all kinds of groups. If they want the information, we will design a presentation that fits what they need. So it would be very different when we talk to middle school kids or to physicians. Obviously, it's going to have to be different for both of those groups. So we try to cater to what are the needs of this group and what do they bring that would be influential or could be influential if they only knew about this issue. What could they do? So all of our presentations focus on what is the issue, who's affected, and always what can they do? What can they do to respond to it in some effective manner?
When I've attended conferences at hotels, I've seen notices posted that say where to call if you suspect someone is being trafficked. That hasn't always been the case in the past, where hotels would post that kind of information. Have you worked with the hotel industry?
Yes, we have. We have a relationship with the Ohio Hotel and Lodging Association. And because of that relationship and our connections with law enforcement and others, the lodging industry locally has come up with what they consider to be best practices for them and how they want their staff to be educated about this.
You named a number of different groups that you work with: hotels, law enforcement, social service agencies, teachers, businesses. Why are there so many groups and such different groups?
Well, this is a very complex issue to address, and nobody has all the answers. Everybody has a piece of it that if they do their jobs appropriately, we can address it together. So we need to be working with all kinds of groups to make a difference on the issue. The social service agencies, the Rape Crisis Center, the courts, law enforcement, all have a piece to play. And so we must do it together. Otherwise, we're going to not have effective measures in place, or we'll be spinning our wheels trying to address only a piece of it without involving all the players that need to be around the table for the sake of the victims and for addressing the criminal aspect of this, helping to stop the demand and curtail the perpetrators.
So it's about the systems that people who have been trafficked or who are being trafficked, about the systems they will encounter and how those systems are prepared to respond effectively.
Yes. So it's really about systemic change, and we're trying to facilitate that kind of change. And it takes a long time. It takes a lot of persistence and staying at the table and being open to what others can bring to the table that can really make a difference.
As you have conversations with different groups, what are some of the questions that you hear from them?
One of the questions we always get is, why aren't you doing more in schools, or are you doing anything in schools? Now, we do get into schools here and there because of a principal that we know or a teacher that we know. And yet getting to a school system is very, very challenging. So that's one of my personal goals, to make that a reality before I retire, that we are into at least one school system so that everybody in that system knows, the administrators, the faculty, the staff, the cafeteria workers, the bus drivers, and the students and parents know about the issue, know how to respond to it. So that takes a lot of work. It is a mandate in our state that teachers know about the issue, but it's an unfunded mandate. And because teachers are so bogged down with all these other things they need to know about, it becomes one of the things that hits the back burner instead. So it's one of those issues that we really just need to keep at and make it happen as best we can. So that's one of the things.
Is your interest in schools because that age group is an especially vulnerable population?
It's definitely a vulnerable population. And when you think about it, they're the next generation that will be inheriting this issue as something they need to continue to address. So if they are knowledgeable, they can keep themselves safe, keep their friends safe, and begin to educate themselves into whatever their business might be upon graduation from college. One of our other efforts is with colleges and universities to integrate this topic into the curricula of all the helping professions. So we've had a little success with that, but there's still a long way to go to get more of the colleges and universities really engaged with this issue, making it something that their graduates will know when they graduate, rather than having to pick it up in continuing education.
We're going to pause for a brief break. This is In Good Faith, a program of A Nun's Life Ministry. We'll be right back.
February 8th is a feast day of St. Josephine Bakita, patron saint for victims of human trafficking. Charlotte Diocese Catholic Charities Human Trafficking Awareness Committee will provide a bilingual prayer service and a discussion about the reality of human trafficking. All are welcome to join us Wednesday, February 8th, 6:15 to 7:15 p.m. at St. Francis of Assisi Church in Lenoir. To learn more, go to www.ccdoc/human-trafficking.
Carolina Catholic Radio is your local EWTN parish and community connection, bringing you local news and information from over 100 parishes in the Charlotte Diocese and Rock Hill Oratory. Catch the spirit. Prayerfully consider a tax-deductible donation today at carolinacatholicradio.org.
Welcome back. You are listening to Sister Maxine of A Nun's Life Ministry and my guest, Sister Anne Victory. Before the break, Anne, we were talking about the various kinds of groups that you offer presentations to and that you talk with about the issue of human trafficking. How do you go about describing to these groups the scope of the problem of human trafficking and the suffering that it brings?
We very rarely will use numbers because numbers are totally inaccurate for the most part. Nobody knows how to count this well. So the numbers that we will use would be the estimates that have been made by the International Labor Organization. So that group has done research and studied what they have determined would be estimates. So they estimate that over 40 million people are enslaved somewhere in the world right now. They also estimate that this is a $150 billion global enterprise. That's a whole lot of money that nobody is benefiting from except the traffickers. So putting it in that sense, that's one of the things that just helps people realize this is huge. And they will ask about what are the statistics in Cleveland. We don't have good numbers, and we know we don't have good numbers. It's a statewide issue. It's a national issue. Nobody's counting this well. The state is working on it. Our facilities in the Cleveland area are also working on it. But we don't have one common tool to use. The health systems are working with what they need to report. The Department of Children and Family Services have statistics that they need to give. Law enforcement has numbers that they need to give. The Rape Crisis Center has numbers. But who knows whose numbers are what, if they're the same or different from in terms of an individual. So it's very messy at this point. And we know we need better documentation of facts, because that's always a question. And people will say, well, it can't be happening. You don't have any numbers. And that's one of the barriers, I think, that because we don't have good numbers, we run into. And this is also very much underreported. Sexual abuse is underreported. Why wouldn't this be? Of course it is underreported. People don't even know what to call it. So we have a long way to go.
And for those who are victims of human trafficking, it would seem that their vulnerability to begin with plays a role in why it's not reported.
That's very true. And they don't even know the words to describe what's happening to them. They may think it's their fault. They've been threatened, forced to do things they don't choose to do. They're ashamed of that. And they don't know how to get out of it. They're just feeling trapped. And if they haven't been threatened, their family members have been, or they say to the person, I'm going to get your grandma if you don't cooperate. So it makes it really, really hard for people to come forward and say what's really happening to them.
If you were to describe trafficking, not by the numbers, but by the people, what are some of the stories that come to mind?
Some have been children. When it first happened to them, they were kids. They didn't know what was happening to them and got trapped in it. And for years lived with that, not knowing a name for it, but lived with the trauma they had experienced. Some were addicted to drugs as part of the process of getting their cooperation or keeping their cooperation. A number have suffered mental illness because of their experiences. So the people that present as a sick individual, say, for instance, who knows what's behind that illness, whether they were being forced to do things that they didn't choose to do and therefore ended up on drugs or mentally ill or with sexually transmitted diseases. Who knows why that happened to them? And so the approach needs to be one that is very centered on not you have this terrible disease, but a much more compassionate approach about what happened? Can you tell me what happened to you? I want to help. Those messages and how we communicate them become absolutely essential to develop the kind of trust that is necessary for people who have suffered in this manner, because they've learned to trust nobody. They've been lied to, they've been abused, and they don't trust automatically. They just don't, for good reason.
What role does poverty play in all of this in terms of, as you say, a root cause?
Poverty can be one of the root causes. You don't have to be poor necessarily to be trafficked, but many, many are. They don't have the basic things that they need or think they need. And so they become desperate. With a child, they don't have a cell phone. They don't have the clothing that they would like. And when someone makes big promises, they'll tend to believe them and go along with it because they're going to be given what they think would satisfy them. These days, I really worry about parents who are desperate for work and they'll agree to anything because they can't support their families with no income. They're going to lose their house. They're going to lose the custody of their kids because they can't pay for what they need. So they get desperate and they'll choose to do something that isn't the best choice. They'll get into something that sounded good and they end up trapped in a human trafficking situation, whether that be for sex or labor.
And we've talked about people who are vulnerable to being trafficked. But what about the other side of that? How would you describe the people who are the traffickers?
Traffickers can be anyone. They're in it for the money. That's what it's about. They want to make money. So it could be organized crime. It could be just an individual who's out there wanting to make money. Sometimes it's family members. It can be someone that you've trusted, like, and often is someone that you know and trust, a teacher, a coach. It can be absolutely anybody. It can be a young teenager who is trying to please the main trafficker by recruiting others to get into this. So it's absolutely anybody. There are lots of faces. They may be people that we encounter every day and wouldn't know that they're actually doing this horrific kind of a crime. And those who, in terms of sex trafficking, those who purchase people for sex, they can actually be anybody too. And they're often identified as upstanding members of the community, which can make it very scary. So it might be that police officer or the judge or the doctor or whoever it might be. So it makes it really, really challenging to work with this issue.
One area where you've done a great deal of work in regard to education and building awareness is in healthcare. And as we talked earlier, you have a lot of healthcare experience. How have you worked with healthcare systems, which seem like they'd be some of the very first places of encounter with people who are being trafficked or who have been trafficked?
I'm very fortunate to work with a wonderful group of experts who are sexual assault nurse examiners, ER nurses, and social workers who are very in touch with the issue, wanting to work together about it so that if you show up in any health facility in the Cleveland area, you will get very similar treatment because we're going to address these particular issues in a particular manner. So we've identified the best practices and are in the process of educating every person in healthcare about how do you respond appropriately to this horrific crime. So we started that back in 2013-14 and made a video in 2016 with those best practices, distributed that video and a manual to all the health facilities in the area, and then it's a process of getting everyone really educated. Now, before we did that, we decided we'd better figure out whether this is really needed. So we did a survey of a sampling of emergency departments in 6 or 8 of the system facilities. So we had all of them represented. We got 197 responses, which was pretty good. It was paper or pencil. They did tell us that they didn't really know the issue, but they were open to learning about it. They were not confident that they could recognize it or address it appropriately, but they wanted to learn. And they told us how they wanted to learn. They wanted to learn with scholarly articles. Now, there weren't many of those in 2014. They said they'd want to learn with online courses. We didn't have anything at that point. And they wanted in-person classes. So as a team of nurses, social workers, and myself, we came up with the idea to make a video. We had no idea how to do that, but we did get a grant to do it, made the video, distributed it, and that has become the basis for how we educate our local healthcare providers. And we've gotten really good feedback. The film is too long. We have to revise it to make it shorter. The manual is very helpful. And now the state is looking at that, at those resources as perhaps something that could be used statewide. It has been distributed to others across the state and the nation now as a resource that could be used. So we're not the only healthcare providers doing that. Other systems throughout the country are addressing it. American Hospital Association is engaged. Catholic Health Association is engaged. The Joint Commission is now concerned about this. They accredit hospitals. So we've been discussing with them, are there standards around human trafficking? 2017, there were no standards. 2018, they began expressing interest. Getting standards in place takes forever, in my experience with the Joint Commission, but we keep prodding them. There are now some codes, diagnostic codes, that specifically identify human trafficking, either for labor or sex, as a way to capture some of the information that is needed. So there's a lot that has happened, but there's a lot more still to do.
As you look back at some of the efforts that you've just described in regard to education and awareness, what are some of the biggest shifts in perception that you have seen in the ways that people understand what human trafficking is and their attitudes about it?
One that is always noticeable to me is when I first started doing this work, when we first started it, we would encounter groups that had never heard the term, as we hadn't heard the term, had no idea what it was. And if they knew about it at all, they thought it happened in Vietnam or Cambodia, but never here. We have become much more aware these days that people have heard of it now. And they'll refer to the fact that they saw that billboard around human trafficking and it brought them up. They called because they wanted more information. They saw that sign that it happens here too. So that's been a real shift that people now recognize it. The other shift is getting the organizations, the various kinds of organizations, to work together. So those are two major things that we've seen happen since we started.
Along this path of education, have you encountered organizations or groups that were outright skeptical or really resistant about whether human trafficking exists?
Oh, yes. There's always at least one or two skeptics in an audience. They just can't take it in. It's a hard thing to imagine that people are still being bought and sold. It just is hard to imagine if we've grown up in a culture where we thought slavery ended. And what do you mean it's still going on? So there are always those. But I'm finding it less and less because people are beginning to be aware that this is a tragedy happening in our time and we need to address it.
As you've moved forward in your work, have you found anyone who has wondered why are Catholic sisters doing this kind of work?
Sometimes we get asked that, and I find it really pretty easy to answer. Historically, we've been on the edges of addressing the needs of the time. That's what we did and continue to do. Now, when we were founded, the needs were education and healthcare primarily, and religious education, those kinds of things. These needs are right before us now. We are the ones who can and need to be the ones addressing the needs of people on our margins, those who are really suffering. So it's really part of our DNA, I think, to respond in a manner like this. And we do it pretty wholeheartedly.
There's definitely that thread of education woven through the tradition of religious life. For yourself, as you began to work on education in regard to human trafficking, what was the biggest thing you had to learn in order to be effective in your role? Things that you had to maybe learn about the subject as well as things you might have had to learn about yourself in order to work in what is an enormously challenging area?
I believe it was a few things. I pretty much knew methods for teaching adults in particular because my graduate work was for patient education. So that became relatively easy in terms of teaching adults. The other thing was allowing myself to really take in this issue and respond to the, in some positive way, about the outrage. So that passion had to come forward And I'm finding that when you're passionate about something like this, and I'm who tend to be pretty quiet and shy, I can speak about this a long time to any group with a sense of urgency and passion and compassion. So that became part of the awareness. The other was certainly different groups need different styles and approaches. And when it's talking with children, I will call on my friends who are elementary educators from the start. They know how to do that well. I'm less likely to be as effective, but I'm learning from them the things that will work for teaching kids that I wouldn't have known because I didn't do that. I didn't ever have that opportunity to teach children. So there are things to learn along the way. There's also whatever a group needs, figure out that organization's mission, what they tend to do, what their business is like, and respond to those things that are going to be of interest to them related to the issue of human trafficking.
May I ask, who are some of the most recent kinds of groups that you have talked with about this?
I recently spoke to a group which is a joint between the FBI and the private sector who want to deal with security issues, cybersecurity in particular. So they're interested in what's happening online and how do we monitor that effectively and those kinds of things. So that's one of the groups. The other that I just last month talked to, a group which is an international group dealing with business ethics for companies that are across the globe. They are concerned about keeping their companies out of the business of falling into human trafficking, or if they get into a contract situation with another company, find out what that company really does, what their supply chain is, and keep the trafficking out of it. So we each bring a piece of the pie to the table and help inform one another about how do we best address this, because it's so complex and touches so many pieces of people's lives.
And it sounds like the international component of this, because people live and move and travel widely, although maybe not in the time of COVID, it seems like the international nature of this is especially challenging.
It really is, and because U.S. Catholic Sisters is a network of the international Talitha Kum, that's helpful for some of these groups that do work internationally to know that there are people on the ground concerned about this issue in various countries around the world. There are people that would want to work with them on resolving some of the matters at hand with regard to human trafficking.
We're going to take just a moment for a brief break. This is In Good Faith, a podcast of A Nun's Life Ministry. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You are listening to Sister Maxine of A Nun's Life Ministry and my guest, Sister Anne Victory, with the Collaborative to End Human Trafficking. Anne, before the break, you mentioned Talitha Kum. Can you say more about that organization and how you're connected to it?
Talitha Kum is the international network of consecrated life addressing human trafficking. And we're privileged as U.S. Catholic Sisters to be one of the networks. There are many throughout the world now of Catholic Sisters primarily, and there are other members as well who are not sisters working on the issue of human trafficking. And we all do it within our own countries or regions to begin to address the core issues, the issue of economic disparity, the migration factor that contributes to this, and the power factor. Those who are treated because they're women as less than and don't have the same power that men across the world, especially white men, have. So those complex issues that underlie this crime of human trafficking make it easy. Unless we begin to address those root causes and do it together, we are going to miss the boat. So that network is really supportive. We have people that we know now in our own hemisphere, but also in other parts of the world that can support each other in our efforts going forward and address things that may need to be addressed or provide services for people who may not be of our own nation even, but are here, are trapped here. We have to be very aware of how we can support each other and how we can begin to work on the issue together.
Your description of the pervasive nature of human trafficking and the complications involved in understanding it, it can almost seem overwhelming. For people listening to this podcast today who want to help but aren't sure where to start, what suggestions would you offer, Anne?
Well, this is something we always include in every presentation because I don't like to leave people feeling powerless. So there are always things that anybody can do, and they run the gamut. Certainly, everybody, if you're of a faith tradition, pray for those who are trafficked, pray for the traffickers that they might have a change of heart. That's always essential. And pray for those who are doing the work. Certainly, people can continue to learn about the issue. That's doing something. They can gather other friends and relatives and other groups that they belong to and have a presentation made so that more are aware. In terms of what they purchase, they can become aware of how labor trafficking happens, how we are all complicit in it without even thinking about it because of the things that we purchase and don't think about the fact that a slave made that or a slave provided me with this coffee or this chocolate. Beginning to have that deepening awareness. And then always, if you think you see this, if you know the red flags and you think you see it going on, whom to call? How do you get help? So those are things that can help people become more responsive and aware and perhaps not feel so helpless. And always they can call and ask more questions.
On the notes for this podcast, I'll include links to organizations, including the collaborative that we talked about today, so people can find more information, including contact information.
That would be helpful. We always do provide the National Human Trafficking Hotline number as well. It's answered in Washington, D.C. 24/7. Anyone can call. You don't even have to identify yourself. They ask two questions when you call primarily. The first one is they assume that you might be a victim. So they are going to say, are you in a safe place? That's their first question. And secondly, they ask, where are you calling from? Because they want to put the person in touch with local resources. So that's what they do. We know that local resources in some places are not very local. And that's a challenge throughout the country, of course. And certainly in our own state, there are places that are much more able to handle issues of human trafficking than others. So that's ongoing work on a much broader level as well. But that hotline number can be helpful. Mm-hmm.
So there are many, many ways that people can get involved.
Yes, there are lots of things that everybody can do something. If they tell two people what they learned, they've done something.
As you've done this work for so many years, work that takes lots of time, energy, faith, collaboration, what has sustained and energized you to continue in this ministry that is so greatly needed in our world today?
Well, one of the things I know is that I never do it by myself. I always have to begin a day with prayer for about an hour at least, so that I'm grounded and can trust that the Spirit will guide me. And we always joke around here in the office that we better stay out of God's way. We don't know what's going to happen. We'll stay out of God's way and not try to get in the way of what God is asking of us. So that sense, and then the sense of supportive networks of people. Certainly, U.S. Catholic Sisters Against Human Trafficking has been a great support. My local colleagues here are a great support, my own community. supports this work and supports me. And I rely on those relationships to bolster me on days when it's feeling like it's too big. I know I have to take breaks from it because some days it is overwhelming and I need to do something else to engage with nature, with art, with music, something else that bolsters my spirit for the work that still lies ahead.
When you mentioned wondering, what will God be asking of us today? Can you reflect on a time recently where God asked of you something that was unexpected, something that you maybe didn't feel prepared for?
One of the things that happened maybe a few months ago is one of our staff members had to leave the organization because she got a job offer she couldn't resist. So she did that. And because of that, I inherited what she was doing. And I was really overwhelmed. And I discovered that I just needed to do it a day at a time. I needed to respond to the needs right in front of me and could rely on others who were working on the issue to help continue the effort, because we don't want to stop the work just because one person has left. It also helped me realize that I better preparing for who's going to do the job when I can no longer do it. So that's one of our efforts as an organization here, to be preparing the next generations to do the work.
Your statement also reflects to me a deep sense that the Spirit is active in this work.
That's absolutely the case. Did I ever think I'd be doing this? My mom used to ask me that question when she was alive and was always interested in what I was doing. Did you ever think you'd be doing this? And my answer was always, no, I didn't. It's not what I envisioned. And yet this is where I'm called. So that's a continuing sense of support and strength that God takes us where we need to be and God supports us in the efforts going forward for the sake of the mission.
As we approach the end of our time here, Anne, one final question. For folks who are seeking some information, I know you mentioned some sources of information earlier, but are there any other sources that someone might want to look into as they seek to learn more about human trafficking?
One, of course, is the U.S. Catholic Sisters Against Human Trafficking website. It's dynamic. It has a lot of really good information, up-to-date information, comprehensive information. So that's a really, really effective website. Others that I refer to often would be the Polaris Project. So polarisproject.org has the very reliable information from across the nation, and they tend to keep it updated very well. Another one would be Shared Hope International, which does focus on sex trafficking primarily. So those are three that stand out for me. The Department of Homeland Security has a website that addresses human trafficking as well, and they have some very good resources on it. So that's helpful as well. There are lots out there. The reliable ones, we do check them out to be sure what is being posted is accurate and informative and not sensationalized, because that's become an issue as well, the sensationalism of things that just aren't true, and all the conspiracy theories that go along with that do nothing to help the cause. So we want to be presenting accurate information.
Thank you so much, Sister Anne, for joining me. I am grateful for this conversation.
Thank you for the opportunity. I'm really humbled by it. So I'm grateful for the chance to speak about this issue affecting so many people who are definitely on the margins.
In Good Faith is a production of A Nun's Life Ministry, helping people discover and grow in their vocation by engaging questions about God, faith, and religious life. This program is made possible through the grace of God and the support of our sponsors and you, our listeners. God bless.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Carolina Catholic Media Showcase. For more information about us, and to support our nonprofit mission of broadcasting the message of Jesus Christ, visit CarolinaCatholicRadio.org and follow, friend, and like us on social media by searching for Carolina Catholic Radio.